This is the Medicast, March 19th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 58. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for picking up the show. I have a lot of brand new listeners out there, I know, so please stick around, check out some other episodes. I've gotten a lot of great listener email this week from new listeners that have said they've enjoyed the show and are checking out the back episodes. So if you haven't done that yet, I urge you to go ahead and do the same. And for all of you long-term listeners, thanks a lot for listening to the show. And without further ado, let's just jump on into some of our listener mail and into the meat of the program. Speaking of two brand new listeners, I heard from listener Mark, a Los Angeles County firefighter paramedic, and listener Jason, a paramedic and instructor out of Indiana, and both of them are brand new listeners to the show, and I just want to urge you guys to feel free to send me news stories that you might find, links to some interesting things, questions, comments, and especially corrections. I'm going to make mistakes from time to time, and I rely on all of you, the listeners, to keep me straight and make sure that I can correct those mistakes so that the other listeners get the correct information. And I want to thank you, both of you guys, for checking in, and I'm glad you're listening to the show and enjoying everything so far. I got another interesting story from listener Chris, and if you check the website at www.medicast.com, you'll see a way that you can comment on any of the blog posts there, on the show notes pages, or on the other stories that I come up with during the week. Chris commented on last week's episode of the Medicast News, my short midweek podcast, and he had a comment about an update for New Jersey law that allows first responders, police officers, firefighters, and EMS personnel to sue for damages where in the past they were not able to do so. So that's a welcome change when there's negligence on the part of business or homeowners or some other person involved in a response. It's nice to know that we can recoup some damages if we're injured in the line of duty in those cases. I also heard from listener Helen in California. Helen and I have met in the past when I was out there last year for last year's Podcast Expo in Ontario, California. If any of you are in that area and would like to catch up with me next year at the Podcast Expo, you can come on by and we can set up a meet and greet. I'll have more on that in the future as the time gets a little bit closer. I'm 95% sure, maybe even 99% sure that I will be attending. I've already registered. What's going to hold me up is if I am tied up in my nursing clinicals next fall. I'm really hoping I'm going to be able to get away for that weekend and get down there or over there to the Podcast Expo. And there are free exhibition hall passes that can be found if you go online and apply for them. They're for free. Anybody that wants to come in just to see the exhibit hall or attend and get into the keynote addresses, you can do that. And it's a great opportunity if you like listening to podcasts. A lot of your favorite podcasters will be there. Guys from Rocket Boom, people from Leo from the Twit team, and all of those guys, Merlin Mann, and just everybody that's involved in podcasting. There's just a lot of them over there. You get an opportunity to meet them, walk around the exhibit hall, see all the cool stuff that's going on, and get a lot of free swag. They're giving away stuff, pens and stress balls and all kinds of things. So check that out if you're interested at podcastexpo.com. And Helen, thank you for your comments on in-flight treatment of emergencies. It seems since I did that episode, I've been getting a lot of email in from providers that were on an airplane and had to deal with some kind of an in-flight emergency or had one crop up. And it's important for us to remember to carry our ID with us because the flight attendants will not let somebody treat a passenger unless they have some form of medical identification that identifies you as a responding provider. So keep that in mind. I also heard from listener With. With is a provider who has been recognized by the American Ambulance Association for their Star of Life program. She's one of 100 providers nationwide selected to represent all of us in Washington to meet her representatives in Congress and to meet the representatives from the American Ambulance Association and other EMS organizations that stand there for us and help us get the legislation passed to protect us and provide us with opportunities to give better care in the field. And With, I just want to congratulate you. I think that's fantastic, and I know you're going to represent all of us very well there. I will have some information on With's blog coming up later in the link of the week. And also, we'll have an opportunity maybe to talk with With a little bit later on when she gets back from her trip, either by interview or maybe we can have her on the Medicast Live program and she can answer questions from all of us. So we'll talk with With when she gets back a little later on, and that all comes together, I believe, sometime later this spring. So we're all pulling for you, With, and I'm glad to hear that you were recognized for this. And hey, a Medicast listener. Go figure. Now let's jump right on into this week's news. And the first item is a story from Montana where a school system is considering putting AEDs into their high schools. All right. So, Jamie, why are you bringing this up again? You bring up AEDs in the schools every time a news story pops up about it. Why is that? Well, I'll tell you. We all know what happens when cardiac arrests happen in the community and there isn't rapid CPR and rapid defibrillation available on the scene. We take dead people to the hospital. Yeah, we do save some of them, and it's a credit to our skills and a credit to our training that we're able to do so. But I'd much prefer to get on scene to find a patient that's recovering from their cardiac arrest and take them to the hospital so they can get more definitive treatment. And that can happen in our communities when they have access to AEDs. And it's not that hard thing to do. The thing in this story that really popped out at me was that the school system considered this proposal after a local Richland County Ambulance Service director met with business and community leaders about AEDs and their value in the community. So here's, again, an opportunity for us to get out into our communities, educate our public about signs and symptoms of cardiac emergencies, of stroke, of CPR classes, all the things we can do to bring out the prevention that we need to get out there into the community. And we can teach about the value of AEDs. We don't have to fund them. They can find the funding for these things. But if we let them know that this life-saving technology is even available, which many of them may not be aware of, we can get an opportunity to get more AEDs into our community and an opportunity for more people to be saved, especially in those rural areas, those places that are at the corners of our response districts that we know we're going to have a 6, 8, 10-minute response time to get to a down person. And if there's an AED closer, maybe there's an AED at the church around the street, maybe there's AEDs carried in local business vehicles that travel around on a regular basis, you know, we can be creative here. They don't have to be tied to a building. They could be tied to a service. And you put those AEDs out there in the community and you provide life-saving care. So I just want to just open the box up for you guys to get out into your communities and really make a difference. Tell people about the things that they can do to help you out. In a similar story, in Central Ohio, EMS agencies combined their efforts with police and fire departments locally to get out and teach safety to the children and people of their communities. And again, this is a thinking outside the box. We don't have to do all of the work on our own. Get together with your local police departments, your DARE teams, your school drug task force teams, your fire departments, your local health departments. Say, hey, let's have a community safety fair. Offer to hold it in your engine bays, pull the equipment out onto the tarmac and let the people come inside, set up tables, and provide access for everyone in your community to come get information about everything. This is a great opportunity for you to teach about gun safety with the police officers right there. Teach about how their drug sniffing dogs work. You come in and you show how you're training people with CPR. You can even hold CPR classes at the same time. You can get out there and educate people about AEDs. There's just, the sky's the limit. You can sit there and go over how to stop severe bleeding. It's a few steps. It takes 5 minutes and you can do a severe bleeding class. Simple, simple things. Talk to little kids about how to call 911. All of these things are great opportunities for us to reach out and educate the public. And this particular article points out that, hey, we don't have to do it all on our own. Combine your efforts, bring everybody in, and everybody shoulders a little bit of the burden. And it's a great opportunity for us to educate our public. Well, if any of you have been following the tragic events recently in Baltimore City with the Baltimore City Fire Department and the death of one of their trainees during a practice fire there, you will be interested to hear that there's more shakeups going on in that department. And it, again, comes in the Fire Academy, where the new director of the Fire Academy found that the person responsible for keeping EMS records had failed to keep documentation of up-to-date medical certificates for at least 22 members, including a deputy chief, three top commanders, and a top union leader, all of whom were required by their job description to carry current EMT cards, at least at the basic level. And yet, none of them had their cards current, and some of them had lapsed as long ago as 1993. Now, this is important to note. These are not people that are providing EMS care. They're not riding the ambulances, but they are fire line officers and firefighters. But it goes to just the whole system there. They seem to be having a problem with accountability in that department, and I hope that they can get this under control. I know that there's a great many very dedicated people down there that are working hard to provide care for their communities, and it seems like their leadership has got some major problems going on. I don't know if it's something catching from Washington, D.C. to the South, but we need to get this worked out, folks. And, you know, if you're a firefighter and you need to have your EMTB current, darn it, go out there and get your refresher course done, get your hours in, and get your EMTB back to where it needs to be. You need to have your minimum level of care. That's just the way it is. You don't have to be the guy that rides the ambulance all the time, but there should be an expectation of a minimum certification if that is a requirement of your job. So hopefully they can get this worked out. Yet another person that has been suspended and may well lose their job at the Baltimore City Fire Academy because of some kind of problem with the way they're doing their jobs there. So for those of you out there that have college campuses in your district or nearby your districts, have you got your people out on spring break yet? It's spring break for me like right now, and I'm really looking forward to having some downtime and not cracking a book every single night. But I know a lot of people, especially the younger ones that I hang out with in my classes, that are heading out to do something on spring break. And one of the things that we talk about a lot here are drug overdoses and recreational drug use. I did some things on heroin in the past. I've covered methamphetamines. I've covered all kinds of narcotics overdoses. One of the things that came out in a recent report from the Centers for Disease Control and the National Center for Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University in New York specifically, they found that prescription drugs are really more of a problem as an up-and-coming issue than illicit drugs on college campuses. And it's because these students are thinking that they can go get the prescription drugs that are in their parents' medicine cabinets at home or in their own medicine cabinets and not risk going to purchase illegal drugs with the dangers involved in making such a purchase. The problem is that they've made the assumption, I think, that when they use a prescription drug, hey, it's a prescribed drug. It's a little bit safer, isn't it? What they don't understand, of course, is, yeah, it's safer in that the amount on the bottle is indeed the amount in the pill. You've got a controlled amount because it's been manufactured by an approved pharmaceutical company. But you still can overdose if you take too much of it, or if you don't understand contraindications because of your own health condition, or mixing medications because you decide to try something from your buddy's pills and he tries some of yours, and before you know it, you're both laying on the floor. So this is going to be a continuing and ongoing issue, and we really need to start looking around for pill bottles when we go on scenes in places, whether it's with college students or young people in our communities. We really need to kind of take a look in the medicine cabinet. If there's an empty drug bottle for Percocet or an empty drug bottle for OxyContin or something like that in there, we need to be making a note of it. Maybe this person is in the middle of a narcotics overdose. One college in particular has tried to deal with this particular problem by adopting a medical amnesty policy, basically saying that if you are drunk or in the middle of an overdose, if you're an underage drinker, or if you've taken an illicit drug, you will not be suspended or dealt with under the college's conduct policy when you call for an ambulance or for medical assistance for yourself or for somebody that you're with. This is happening at Lehigh University. And, you know, this is something that I think makes a lot of sense. We need to treat this as a medical problem. I know that there's a conflict, is drug overdose and drug addiction and drug abuse a medical problem or a legal problem? And I am a person who falls strongly on the side of this is a medical issue. These people have a medical problem. If we educate people properly, if we get them the treatment they need and we back that treatment up, we can cure this problem. We can stop the drug abuse. We can put them in jail all day long. And if we don't treat the problem, they'll come back out still drug abusers, and we won't have solved the problem at all. So I think this is a great policy to have. And it kind of leads me into the thought that we need to be making sure that we develop a trust and a rapport with our patients. And I talk about this on other occasions when I've talked about young female patients and asking them quietly and out of the way, hey, is there a possibility you could be pregnant? You don't want to do that in front of their parents. You want to do that where they're alone, maybe just after you load them in the back of the ambulance before mom climbs in. Go ahead and quickly ask that question. This is the same type of thing. The police are called in for an overdose. There's police everywhere. There's people in uniforms everywhere. You ask somebody how many beers they've had. Let's all say it together. How many beers? It's always two, right? Oh, I just had a couple of drinks, or I only had two beers. We know that they had more than two beers just from the way they're acting. But we have to get them alone and build a rapport and build that level of trust and tell them, hey, I'm your medical treatment provider. I'm not here and I'm not the police and I'm not going to report you to the police. I need you to tell me so I can treat you exactly what happened. How many beers did you have? Did you drink anything else? Did you take any drugs? Tell me now so I can get you the treatment that you need and we can save your life and take care of you. I'm only going to tell and pass that information on to the doctor and the nurses at the hospital. Okay, so please trust me. Build that rapport with your patients. Let them know that confidentiality is taken seriously, and then make sure you keep it confidential, especially if you're a provider in an ambulance service on a college campus. I've talked with several listeners by email that are medical providers at college campuses. I've mentioned it here on the show, and that's in a difficult position because you have an opportunity to really help out your fellow classmates and students, but you also have to be really careful about the confidentiality issues and that you do not share your latest fun call with everybody you know, because it's not hard to put the pieces of the puzzles together to figure out, well, you picked up somebody, you broke their nose when they fell down, and we heard Joey fell down. Well, guess what? They know that you picked up Joey. Okay? So we need to go ahead and take that one step further and maintain that confidentiality after we build that rapport. So I think it's great that Lehigh University has adopted this policy, and it just kind of teaches us a lesson and reminds us to treat our patients like the medical patients that they are. All this talk of drug abuse kind of brings me around to this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week I thought I would talk a little bit about unresponsive patients. You know, we look at drug abuse and we look at the causes of different things, and we come up on unresponsive patients, and really, we go through a lot of our training to get medical history, sample history, all that stuff. You come upon an unresponsive patient, especially in a situation like a college party, and nobody knows who this person is. In fact, if you come upon like a building or an apartment where an underage party is going on, people are jumping out the windows, and you get into the building, and the only person there is the unresponsive person. You know nothing about this guy or girl. You have to go in strictly on your protocols and on your ability to do a thorough medical examination on this patient. One thing to note briefly about unresponsive people: alcohol may cause altered mental status, but alcohol abuse rarely causes complete unresponsiveness to pain. So if you're providing painful stimulus, you should get some kind of a response out of a person that is merely under the effects of alcohol, unless they are in some kind of an alcohol-induced coma. So just so you understand that, a drunk person may be pretending to be passed out, but you should be able to elicit a response. And if you truly can't, after you've administered a true pain response or painful stimulus, then you can move on into treating them as a real unresponsive subject. First of all, you want to get a pulse ox on the patient. You want to check them for some kind of a medical alert ID, medic alert bracelet, any of those things that may identify them as a diabetic patient, a patient with an acute allergy, and any other medical problem that may be the reason for their unresponsiveness. If you have it in your protocol to do so for an unresponsive person with unknown etiology, you want to go ahead and administer 10 to 15 grams of glucose paste between the cheek and gum as indicated. If you have the ability to provide glucometer testing, then go ahead and do that and follow your protocols for that. Generally, less than 60 or 70 on the glucometer, you're going to want to go ahead and administer glucose paste, or if you're an ALS provider, you're going to want to administer D50 or glucagon. If you're an ALS provider, go ahead and start IV therapy, start a complete head-to-toe. You're looking for all kinds of different things: needle marks, bruises that may indicate a traumatic fall. You want to go ahead and check for anything that may be laying around, like pill bottles, indications of maybe they've an alcohol punch or something that's been spiked into the punch. If there are bystanders, ask the police officers to leave, or ask your partner to grab one of them that seems to know the person and take them aside quietly and see if they can find out exactly what's going on. Again, this is one of those situations. I don't like to think of us as being adversarial with police, but in the situation where we have to treat a medical patient and we don't have a clue what's going on, we really need to kind of get them aside or find some way to isolate the people that may be able to give us a better medical history. If your patient has constricted pupils and is in respiratory distress or respiratory depression, unresponsive, you may want to suspect narcotic overdose. Go ahead and administer Narcan, also known as naloxone, starting at 0.4 up to 2 milligrams, slow IV push. Follow your own protocols on that. And remember that there are some fentanyl heroin crossbreeds out there that may require up to 10 milligrams of Narcan. So be prepared to consult for additional doses of Narcan. If you think this is a narcotics overdose, you want to go ahead and consider the fact that it may be a mixture of narcotics and that you may need to really slam the Narcan into them to get any kind of response. Consider additional doses of Narcan, monitor your vitals carefully, get the best history you can, and you need to disrobe this patient. If they are truly unresponsive, you need a complete head-to-toe assessment on them. You know, you're going to feel like a complete idiot to get this person to the hospital and the nurse lifts up their legs and finds a snake bite. Now, I know that's an unusual situation, and maybe the snake bite isn't going to cause what they've got going on. I don't know. But, you know, these are the kind of things you need to look for. It might be a bee sting. This may be an anaphylactic reaction. All of these things. You're not going to see the hives if you don't disrobe a person wearing long sleeves or winter coat. You're not going to see that they're having an allergic reaction. So you need to go through your protocols. You need to do your ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation. You need to, you've already checked and they're unresponsive, so they have that disability. You're going to go to your E's and you're going to expose the patient. You want to do a complete head to toe. Be very thorough. If you suspect trauma, use C-spine precautions. You want to log roll that person. And then you want to go into your causes of unconsciousness. I have a link in the show notes to a page on AEIOU tips. What is AEIOU tips? Well, it's a mnemonic device that helps you remember the causes of unconsciousness, okay? And these are things that you can use in the back of your mind to consider, okay? AEIOU tips: alcohol or acidosis, epilepsy, environmental or electricity, insulin, which of course means they're having a sugar problem, overdose, uremia, basically a toxic state with blood caused by kidney failure, trauma, infection or sepsis. You're looking for P, which is poisoning, psychosis, and then seizures, stroke, or shock. AEIOU tips, T-I-P-S. These are all things that can be causes of unconsciousness. And if you use this mnemonic device, it's going to help you keep in the back of your mind while you're doing your full head-to-toe assessment on this patient. And folks, if you can get them in the ambulance first, do that, because if there is a party going on, you've just provided the central form of entertainment for the darn thing. But you're going to go ahead and do your full head-to-toe and keep these things in the back of your mind. Alcohol or acidosis, epilepsy, environmental, electricity, insulin, overdose, uremia, trauma, infection, poisoning or psychosis, seizure, stroke, or shock. All of these things are causes potentially of unconsciousness or altered mental status, and you can go ahead and use this device to help you with your assessment. Get them on a heart monitor, get a set of vital signs, get multiple sets of vital signs. You really want to trend these patients. So set your heart monitor and your vital signs machines, if you're taking them automatically, to recycle every 5 minutes. Really get a lot of vitals so you can trend and see what's going on. If you have inline capnography, this will be a great time to check and see if they are acidotic. Okay, we have the opportunity to do that in the field. Learn how your capnography devices work. They're not just there to allow you to check for tube placement. They really are a great indicator of gas exchange and general tissue perfusion, because you can see how well the body is metabolizing oxygen and getting the waste back out again. So again, use all your tools and then consult with medical command. Let them know what you've got coming in. They're going to have to do a full set of drug screens, a full set of labs to figure out exactly what's going on. Don't feel like you're alone in the situation when you have an unresponsive subject. Believe me, when the doctors get these patients in, they stand there and scratch their heads too. But you can start care. You can get an IV established. You can provide supportive care. If you've got a problem with your blood pressures, then you go ahead and put them in Trendelenburg. If you've got a problem with their breathing being depressed and you can't get Narcan to knock them out of it, if you suspect narcotics, go ahead and bag them. Okay, we can take care of supportive measures for these patients in many ways. Get them to the hospital where they can get more definitive care. So that's this week's tip and trick of the week, how to deal with unresponsive patients, a little bit of an overview on the treatment of them, and maybe this will help you the next time you have somebody that's got you scratching your head and they can't tell you what's wrong for themselves.
This is Rob Cefuto, the Director of Marketing for Raw Voice, representing our Blueberry Podcast community. And I'd like to interrupt this podcast for just one moment to tell you about a new charitable campaign that we're organizing. It's called the Blueberry Jam to Fight Cystic Fibrosis. And we're teaming up with PodSafe Music artist Brother Love and the Boomer Esiason Foundation to benefit the Exercise for Life Scholarship Fund. Cystic fibrosis is a disease of the lungs that is diagnosed at a very early age and cuts the life expectancy of individuals with the disease to 37 years. Proper diet and regular exercise can help to improve the quality of life and extend the average lifespan. Cystic Fibrosis podcast host Jerry Cahill is living, breathing proof that this can happen. And we are very, very proud to be working with Jerry and the Boomer Esiason Foundation and Brother Love on this effort. All the information you need to know can be found at blueberryjam.com. That's blueberryjam.com. And there are many, many ways that you can get involved, whether you're an audience member, a blogger, a podcaster, or even a musician. We've got something for you to get involved. One more thing. We're going to have a live show on April 7th in New York City. Brother Love will be performing, and he will be releasing his brand new album at that live show. So you won't want to miss it. So I appreciate you taking the time to listen to this promo for the Blueberry Jam. And remember, get all the information you need to know and make a donation over at blueberryjam.com. We now return you to your regular podcast programming.
Thank you, Rob, for bringing that promo out here. Folks, head on over to blueberryjam.com. Check it out. There's lots of different ways you can help. If you can't afford to give a donation, maybe you can put a link to this site on your website, or if you have a band or if you support a band that you like in your community, let them know about the site. There's opportunities for bands to have their music played at blueberryjam.com, and they can support and let folks know when they're playing their gigs in their communities about the Blueberry Jam and the Boomer Esiason Foundation. Cystic fibrosis is a horrible disease, and it really just chokes the life out of people. It fills people's lungs with thick mucus that cannot be coughed out, that can't be loosened up, and eventually these people just drown from occluded lung space. So let's do what we can to find a cure for this disease and help the people that have the disease exercise effectively to prolong their healthy lifespan. Okay, let's jump on into this week's Med of the Week. Because I'd been talking about prescription medications that are abused, I thought I would talk about one of the number one abused prescription medications, oxycodone. Oxycodone, also maybe known as OxyContin, comes in many different forms mixed with other medications in the prescription form. But basically, at its basic form, it is a potent and potentially addictive opioid analgesic medication. It is derived from codeine, and it is often marketed in combination with aspirin or ibuprofen or acetaminophen, and it can be put in a sustained release form, which we find most often as known as OxyContin. The problem comes when this pain medication is used for too long, the person becomes addicted to it, or other people that are addicted to narcotics get a hold of OxyContin from relatives who took it until they didn't need the pain medication anymore and still had half a bottle sitting in the medicine cabinet, and it disappears one day, and hey, guess what? Aunt Jean didn't notice it because she never needs that medication anymore since she got her knee operation. But, you know, somebody else is out there using that med and abusing it. In recreational use, it can be used, basically, they take the tablets and crush them up, mixing the powder either with the liquid and injecting it or snorting it orally, intranasally. They may also give intramuscular or subcutaneous injections. They may even shove the powder rectally inside of them to absorb it more rapidly into the bloodstream. It's particularly dangerous when people inject OxyContin since it contains binding agents that are in the pill that enable the time release of the medication. When the binders are injected into the bloodstream, this can cause additional problems. Oxycodone has similar effects to morphine and heroin, and it appeals to the same community. So you may see people that have robbed local pharmacies. If you hear about that, you want to find out what was taken. Most often, that could be OxyContin, and they will you might have a spate of OxyContin overdoses in your community. It's a highly regulated medication, and it can be quite expensive when marketed illegally. So you want to be careful, because there could be firearms involved or any other things that may be associated with illicit drug trade. Like other opioids, oxycodone can be fatal in high doses or combined with any other depressant medication or substances like alcohol. You want to treat this patient like you would any other opioid overdose, narcotic overdose. You want to get your Narcan out and get it on board. You also might want to find out if the patient is taking anything else, because sometimes people try to double up and take OxyContin with fentanyl or other medications to increase their high. Signs and symptoms you're likely to see in the field with oxycodone are those you would typically see with any kind of narcotic overdose. Frequently, you're going to see lightheadedness, dizziness, general sedation, and also nausea and vomiting, so be ready to protect that airway. Other side effects may include drowsiness, constipation, and this also may cause spasms of the ureter, which can lead to difficulty in them urinating. And so if you have a patient that's had an ongoing problem with OxyContin abuse, they may have some kind of a renal insufficiency or some kind of a ongoing renal problem, maybe even early stages of renal failure. So you want to kind of keep an eye on them. They may be throwing some anomalies on their EKGs related to them retaining high levels of electrolytes like potassium or calcium or other things, and you just want to kind of be aware of that overall. Generally, you're going to treat this with Narcan if it's symptomatic, or palliative care if they're conscious and reasonably alert, and just monitor the patient and get them to the hospital. Again, a good history and a good rapport with these patients can alleviate problems and get a better idea of what they have exactly going on. So that's this week's Med of the Week, OxyContin, also known as oxycodone. And this drug is present in many different forms, but you will see oxycodone on the label if it's combined with another medication like aspirin or ibuprofen or Tylenol. So look carefully at your medical labels on the prescriptions, because it will let you know what the total active ingredients are if it's a combination medication. I want to thank you all for supporting the show, because it's time to wrap things up here at the Medicast. As always, you can check out the website at www.medicast.com. There will be links in the show notes there to all of the items that I've talked about here tonight. You can head on over to the website. You scroll down a little bit on the left-hand side. You'll see all the category headings for the Medicast Live, the Medicast News. And if you click podcast, you can look at all of the show notes entries for all of the podcasts that I do here on the Medicast. So you can find all those links there. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com, and you can also call in to me. I'd love to hear from you. So if you're out there driving around right now and you have an opportunity to do so, you can program me into your cell phone at some point and give me a call while you're listening to this show. Pause your iPods or your CDs if you're listening to it in that form, and give me a holler and let me know if you have a strong opinion about something I've said. Again, I welcome all of your comments, your questions, your suggestions, and your corrections. I want to make this a community effort, folks, so please get out there and let me know. You can reach me at the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's area code 941-30-MEDIC. You can also sign up for the Medicast newsletter so you get a heads up when things are coming along. That means once a week or so, you're going to get a list of all of the links from tonight's show. You'll also get a heads up that the show's available for download, and just for Medicast newsletter subscribers, an extra tip and trick of the week at the bottom of the newsletter. You can head on over there and get that all at the Medicast site in the upper right-hand corner. Just click on the free newsletter sign up link and you'll get the Medicast newsletter sent directly to you. I'm going to wrap things up here, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. And this is an artist that I've played some music from before, Laura Clapp. Usually I think I've played one or two of her more upbeat songs, but this is really just a fantastic, soulful performance by Laura. It's a live version that I don't know if it's available over at iTunes, but you can find the rest of her music over at the iTunes store. And I have a link to that directly in the show notes. So without further ado, I'll head on and leave you with Laura Clapp's version of Not For Me, the live version. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Shouldn't life be easy now? Now that I'm over you, shouldn't I be able to breathe? Now that I'm over you, but why do I care? And why can't I laugh? And why do I fall to pieces every time I see your photograph? Is it because I'm not over you? But I know I can't go where you now that I'm